You're in the panel, Sunspots, the Promise of Pitfalls of Gov 2.0. And when I was writing that title, I really had trouble coming up with the idea that, you know, we all talk about sunshine and open government, and there's some spots showing up in that area. So we want to talk a little bit about where the open government and transparency and Gov 2.0, I guess you would call it space, has changed in, and what the problems are still there. I'm joined by Vivek Kundra, who is the former Chief Information Officer of the United States, starting out in Arlington, Virginia, and going through Virginia. And he was the CIO in D.C. when I was a reporter at the Washington Post, so I know his work well. I'm also joined by Tom Lee, who's the director of Sunlight Labs. And they've done a lot of work at Sunlight. Anybody who's in this room probably knows what Sunlight is, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time describing it. My name's Sarah Cohen, and I come from the journalism background. I was a reporter and editor for 20 years, and most of that career on investigative teams at the Washington Post. So the strength of this panel is not so much that you're going to hear so much new about what's happening in open government, but more we felt that the strength of this panel is three very different views on how open government is and isn't working. And we're going to start with Vivek, since we thought that coming from the public sector, he would be the best one to kind of talk about what was happening and give us an inside view of what was happening, at least at the federal level recently.
Great. Thanks, Sarah. What I thought I would do is just quickly reflect on the evolution of open government through my experience, whether it was at the local level, state, or at the federal level. I still remember what struck me the most was actually my time in Virginia, when we decided to actually release data around the performance of small women and minority-based businesses. When the governor came into office, he basically said that he had a policy objective to make sure that 40% of discretionary spending was actually moving in the direction of small women and minority businesses, which used to be a promise that every governor had made before, but he actually wanted to make sure that we were executing against that. So I sat down with the governor, and we talked about the opportunity there, and realized that the machine of government was very much broken in terms of how this information was collected, how it was disseminated. What we found was that what would happen is agencies would actually just report up, say, here's what they were doing in terms of their performance. And then in a very closed, secretive ecosystem, they would get evaluated. The government would massage the results and put them on a website and call that open government. And the deep insight there was I realized that there was a new, better, faster way to do this, which was to disintermediate all the government players internally. What I mean by that is we decided to say, well, where's all the spending data coming from? We realized that all the credit cards in the state of Virginia were issued by GE Finance. And then we also realized that we had this massive central database around every single government contract in terms of how it was issued, but it wasn't necessarily made public. So taking the raw data from the credit card system, tying it to the contracting database, putting up a really simple dashboard with the name of every cabinet secretary and saying, here's how they're performing against their objective, that ended up fundamentally shifting what was going on in terms of performance, because these cabinet secretaries now all of a sudden had their face out there in the public domain and their performance. And they were highly motivated in terms of incentives to actually execute rather than just talk about all the reasons why they weren't meeting their objectives. But the governor also started calling them in to talk about why they weren't reaching the performance objectives that were set in place. So to me, that was sort of the first lesson of what really happens when you open up the performance of government and achieving results. So when I moved to D.C. government, one of the first things I decided to do is said, well, interestingly, the Virginia experience taught me that you can change performance when you open up the inner workings of government. So I decided to make a very simple policy change, which is to start saying, well, every single data set that we have in D.C. government, the default was going to be that it would be open. But there was a lot of fighting to make that happen, from data around crime. And what I didn't realize was a challenge around the evaluation of whether it was a police chief or units under the police chief, because the number of homicides kept getting revised over the years because of poor record keeping. I was just like, this makes absolutely no sense. Why wouldn't we release this information on a real-time basis, not realizing how sensitive the issue was? Same thing with education. Same thing with basic government services, from real-time tracking of where snowplows were to real-time information around, you know, how potholes were being fixed or how much consultants were being paid on an hourly basis. Releasing all that information actually created a huge shift sort of internally within the government itself. But the deeper insight was actually what happened beyond just releasing the data, which is a competition we launched called Apps for Democracy. And through that competition, I realized that the ecosystem of innovation wasn't really necessarily in the government, but it was sort of many of the people, the profile of the people here at South by Southwest who are innovators creating some really interesting applications. So we tapped into this, not just this hunger and desire to build applications, but also new ways of thinking about how government services should be delivered. And I still remember, you know, that at that time with the election looming, and we were thinking about who would end up winning the election, and it ended up being President Obama, and there was just like this massive inflow of people that were coming into the district. And we were trying to figure out, well, wow, how do you manage about 1 million people, which were the projections of folks coming into Washington, D.C.? And this one person started creating apps around helping people customize their own personalized tours based on the information that we put out there to bus schedules and routes. So that would have cost the government millions of dollars, which was done, by the way, the whole competition was $50,000. So we saw a lot of innovation come out of there, saving the government money. But more important than just the savings was tapping into the innovative spirit of people in the District of Columbia and across the country. And then in the Obama administration, on the first full day in the administration, the president focused on this notion of open government and open, transparent, participatory government. And given the scale of the federal government, right, I think you'll hear a lot about the sunspots. But also, you know, there, the notion of just quickly executing and scaling some of the best practices. We started to see this open data movement from D.C. government was being scaled now in New York City and San Francisco, but also in other countries around the world, from the U.K. to Australia to Japan and states within the U.S. And so we wanted to figure out, well, what were the lessons learned there that could be scaled super fast across the entire federal government? So the notion of releasing data became one of the first objectives. But what's really interesting about that is what high-value data means to different agencies was interesting, because I remember the first conversation I had with the CIA. They said, well, the data we're going to release is the, you know, cafeteria menu that we have every day. And so you started seeing sort of uneven, you know, execution on what is data and what is valuable. I think that's one of the questions we struggled with the most, because it wasn't also very clear from the open government communities in terms of what is considered high-value data sets. You would ask 10 groups, you'd get 10 different answers in terms of what the priority was. So I think the agency struggled early on in terms of what is the order of operations and what are the different sets of priorities. But you did see, you know, the numbers of data sets go from 47 to over 400,000. But I think we need to pivot away from just measuring the number of data sets. I think phase one was all about democratizing data, trying to change the default position of government from closed, secretive, opaque to being much more open, transparent, and participatory. But I think the next sort of frontier is going to be much more about how do you disrupt entire sectors of the economy, but also how do you make sure from a journalism perspective that meaningful information is provided and then create an ecosystem of startups that can build the next set of billion-dollar companies on top of this open data.
Thanks. Tom, you want to go ahead?
Yeah. So first, thank you all for making it out. This is it was hard enough for me to get here. I actually was on the hook for it. As Sarah mentioned, I am the director of Sunlight Labs at the Sunlight Foundation, and I will bore you for just a second so that folks know where I'm from. Sunlight's a nonpartisan nonprofit that tries to use technology to make government more transparent and accountable. And we do this a bunch of different ways. We've got, you know, lobbyists, we've got journalists, we've got organizers. The department that I run is the labs, which is one of the things that makes us unique. We have a much larger investment in technology than a lot of folks in this space. We've got about 20 developers and designers who not only, you know, work with data that's published by government to make it more accessible, to provide novel interfaces around it, we also work with government to talk about how their offerings can be improved. So, you know, we have developers who might be creating web interfaces or mobile apps, but who are also talking to folks on the Hill about legislation that will change the source data, or they're talking to folks at agencies about what formats they ought to be releasing things in. So it puts us in, I think, I hope, a unique position to talk about what government's doing right and wrong from a slightly different perspective than, say, the journalistic one that Sarah represents. What I want to use these opening remarks to talk about before we get into what I hope will be kind of a conversation between us and with you is just sort of what's the context here? I think that there's a pretty long history to the open government movement, and it's important to keep some perspective about what failures we should be understanding around and which ones we really need to keep an eye out for, because sometimes the latter class are more pernicious and subtle and call for us to be not complacent. So Gov 2.0 is in the title of this panel, but it's important to remember that this is actually, like, Gov 2.0 is much newer than open government. It's actually, a term that was coined by Tim O'Reilly, and Bill Eggers. Oh, man. All right. Sorry. The representative of O'Reilly Media is correcting me here. Certainly, Tim has done a lot to promote the concept, and I think that that's been extremely valuable. It's catalyzed a lot of enthusiasm around this question and got a lot of new developers, people using new technologies, engaged with these problems of government. But open government is a concept that's been around at least since World War II with the Administrative Procedures Act. There's actually a paper came out a couple weeks ago from you and Robinson looking at kind of the history of this term. And the concept at least is from the first half of the 20th century. And I suspect you could find instances before that. When you start talking about data specifically, you can look at the census has been releasing data since the birth of this country and really hardcore GIS-y stuff since the 60s. What's equally old is cynicism and disillusionment over how far government's coming on these open data efforts. One of the first things that happens to you when you get to Sunlight is you meet Bill Allison, who runs our journalism department, and Bill, you know, will probably, like, take you out and smoke a cigar with you, and then he'll tell you, you got to watch this show called Yes Minister. It's great. And so this is a BBC show. It's almost exactly as old as I am. And it involves a new, newly elected official in the British government who comes with a lot of ideas about reform to take care of the problems, the obvious shortcomings of government that, it just seems like it should be so easy to fix. There's just been so many, like, jerks and idiots that preceded him, and now he's going to correct all these shortcomings. And it's a comedy basically about how the career civil servants constantly stymie these efforts and about all the challenges that actually exist to this kind of open governance. And not coincidentally, the first episode's title is called Open Government. So this is like a maximally cynical interpretation of this movement, which has existed for a long time. So it's important to keep in mind, I think, that there are these cycles of enthusiasm and disillusionment. I see them with the people I work with. I see them with, you know, folks like you in this room. So we need to keep a bigger perspective. There are often good reasons for why government falls short. One project that we worked on at Sunlight was something called Elena's Inbox. And it was actually an idea that came from Twitter from this guy named Bob Brigham. He tweeted at us and said, hey, they're releasing now Supreme Court Justice Kagan's emails from her time in the Clinton administration. When are you guys at Sunlight going to put them in a Gmail interface so we can actually make sense of them? And saw this, it's like, wow, that is a fantastic idea. We need to steal this. We'll get invited to all kinds of journalism conferences to talk about it. So we did it. Before we implemented it, though, it meant that I had to ruin a weekend or two of my time because the data wasn't great. It was released as PDFs, which isn't a good starting point necessarily. They were text PDFs, but they were text PDFs of printouts of emails, which doesn't make a ton of sense, right? This is stuff that was in a digital system called ARMS, the something record management system, that apparently had been printed out from the Clinton Presidential Library where they were collected, and then faxed to whoever was responsible for the release. Those faxes or scans were then taken and OCR'd. So, like, at the bottom of every page, there was something about the ARMS system, except often it was called the PERM system. And there was not usable identifiers. There was just a ton of regular expression parsing to be done to say, like, this sender who's responsible for all these emails, they have to be rolled up together. Or this thread that happens at various points throughout the email system should all be collected together. So it wasn't necessary. If we had the source database, it wouldn't have been a problem to reconstruct this stuff. But we didn't, and we had to kind of suffer through. And, you know, we got something up online that people seemed to like. It was a big success. And I went on to write some blog posts about how the people who had released this data were fools and really just needed to see the light about how to release information. And then a few months later, I met them, and they were extremely gracious, and they said, well, actually, we didn't have a choice because we have to put all this stuff through a redaction workflow. And you can't do a redaction workflow digitally. Too many people have been burned by drawing black boxes over text and PDF that you can still highlight. So we have to print it all out, go through with markers, scan it back in, and OCR it. That's not great, and tools could make a big difference here. But it wasn't that they didn't know better. It was just that there was some, you know, actual requirement of government that the private sector might not face or might be able to ignore, that wasn't an option here. In other cases, though, I think that we do see problematic behavior. And it's less about sort of making bad technology decisions than it is just a lack of ambition. I'm thinking in particular of a website called FAPIS. It's part of a constellation of contractor oversight websites. There's the Excluded Party List System. There's one, I forget what the acronym stands for. It's PPIRS, which is adorably called Peepers. And FAPIS is one of these websites where, like, if you're overbilling the government or if your employees are killing a bunch of Iraqis or something like this, you know, something problematic, we are going to actually record this data and say that you are not going to do business with us anymore. Or at least we're going to keep a record of the problems you've had in the past so that when something new comes up, we'll be able to look at it and make a decision about whether the government's going to keep doing business with you. So reporters have been fighting to open up FAPIS for a really long time, and they finally got it, and it was awful, awful website. Probably the worst website you've ever seen. Like, radio buttons used as checkboxes, so you can't uncheck them. Didn't work in anything except Internet Explorer and Firefox. You had to enter a CAPTCHA to get any of the data out, except the CAPTCHA was broken, so if you know how to write Scraper, you could break it. Terrible. But all of this paled in comparison to the fact that there was no historical data at all. When FAPIS launched, it was an empty website, despite years and years' worth of information about these contractors who had been behaving badly. And this was basically because there was a political price to pay with this community of people who were in the database. And there's a question of incentives. Like, what's the upside to pissing all these people off? Really, you get maybe some applause from reporters who then get the actual credit for breaking the story about this historical stuff. But as a bureaucrat, you just have a bunch of angry phone calls coming into you. And this is something I'm hoping that we can talk about a little bit here, this question of incentives. Another example I'd like to point to is the Federal Election Commission, the FEC, released a mobile app a couple of weeks ago, and it was not great. You know, it does include, like, meeting audio of the FEC, so, like, if you're at the gym and you want to really listen to the six commissioners talk about super PACs and how they're not going to do anything about them, you've got some problems, but you can being able to listen to it on the go is no longer one of those
problems. Or you spend too long in Washington.
Yes. It also had some problems with, like, if you looked up Herman Cain's page, for instance, the numbers were just wrong. Like, his debts were listed under his assets. So under the contributions pie chart, lots of pie charts, one of the slices was total contributions, which didn't make any sense at all. So this was a problem, right? But these were all correctable problems. The bigger issue was that, like, why was this agency producing a mobile app? Why were they not addressing the fact that, even apart from whether or not they want to enforce our election laws, the fact that it takes outside nonprofits to roll up contributions by sort of donor entity, let's say, you know, by employer of contributors, that's a manual text matching process that relies on an incredible amount of detailed knowledge. For instance, like, if you see Exxon as an employer, you have to know what's the structure of Exxon. Are franchisees who run individual gas stations part of the overall corporate structure or not? This is going to vary by petrochemical company. So you actually need this contextual information. There's no identifier to roll it up. That's the kind of like thankless but really important task that I would like to see government tackling instead of the ones that they can get credit for, which is a mobile app, even if it's a bad mobile app. So that's the perspective I'm coming from, I think, which is that this stuff is really hard. Government is facing a lot of incentives that aren't always obvious to those of us on the outside until you dig in. And by and large, the people in it are incredibly conscientious and hardworking. But there is, I think, at times a lack of ambition and the set of incentives facing them for opening more data and for really providing transformational data are not there yet. So I'm hoping we can get into that a little bit more.
Great. And I'm just going to try to quickly follow up with the perspective from journalism. I'm going to focus mainly on the role of journalists as holding government accountable. And so a lot of the data that we're talking about are not going to be particularly useful for that purpose. And that doesn't mean they're not useful for other purposes and doesn't mean that it's not a good thing to have it out. I think the way that we usually think of things is if a government agency spends, regulates, prosecutes, or inspects, we want the record. So the idea is that in journalism, we're generally looking for artifacts of governing, the individual records that are created as part of the act of governing in order to hold people accountable, rather than useful data to make apps out of. So it's kind of a different perspective, and it's one that often sets up a more confrontational relationship than necessary just because we're not understanding what open government means from the journalism community. Now, having said that, there are a lot of things that are happening in open government that make journalists' jobs a lot easier. And as a great example, it used to be that at a newspaper, you spent a lot of time compiling the weekly crime report to put into what was called Agate. It looked like classified ads. And you did that because, sure, your readership wanted it, but you were swarmed with ads and you had to have some content to put around them. So you spent a lot of time putting together the crime reports. This idea that you no longer have to do that, you can point to a government website that's already doing it, is awesome and making it a lot easier for everyone. That's not to say that news organizations don't do their own crime reports, but the process of getting them has been revolutionized in the last 10 years or so. I think that one of the things that has really changed very slowly and very sporadically, and Vivek alluded to it, is that we always used to say that when we asked agencies at the local or federal level for access to records, there was no, you would never get in trouble for not saying no. There was absolutely nothing that could happen to you bad if you just didn't let the records out. And with this change of culture that Vivek has alluded to, that all of a sudden people are seeing inside government that there is a cost to saying no. If you think about it, if you're being asked for information, and often if you're being asked for information by a journalist, and in particular investigative journalist, this is not going to end well a lot of times for the people you work for. You're being asked for records that might very well show that a contractor is doing something wrong and the government didn't catch it, or that an inspection wasn't done, or something like it. So when you're trying to figure out how easy to make that process, it's a natural human instinct to say, gosh, you know, I don't know if we can let that out because we don't even know what's in it ourselves. And I think that that's quite natural. Now the idea of that cultural change where people are saying, you know what, it doesn't matter. We're going to let people see it and let them go through it, and it's not our job to keep it to ourselves. It also kind of gets us back to the idea that this is our government, it's the people's government, and it's not some private company that gets to decide what we want to know when we should know it. I joke that some local governments kind of have the mommy mentality of that you can't be trusted with data, so we can't give it to you. And that culture has really changed through open government. I would argue, though, that the idea, President Obama outlined this idea of three elements of open government, and which kind of wraps into the Gov 2.0 idea: participation, collaboration, and transparency. And from the perspective of someone who deals almost exclusively with the transparency side, I think I would argue that it's been much more successful on the other two elements than on the transparency side. I just have to say there's a, and this is old, so I don't know for sure whether it's changed with the new mayor, but I just noticed that D.C. Just won an open government contest of some kind. And there's a very strong data release program that Vivek started, or even your predecessor started, right, Suzanne, in D.C. that proactively lets all of these data sets out, and that's great. But at the Washington Post, we had huge fights with the mayor's office for years that would end in absolutely getting no information whatsoever, even after his own attorney general had told him that it was illegal to keep it secret. So you kind of get this distance between the freedom of information records side and the open government side. And I think it's worthwhile to think of those as separate things, and that they're not always complementary. And that's the big thing. I just had two other things. We haven't really talked about data quality issues. And one of the things that I find frustrating about using the fruits of open government in a Gov 2.0 environment is that we have no ability to evaluate the data quality. I did a story in 2008, I believe, that involved looking at a lot of housing inspection data out of D.C., and we really wanted to publish this data because it wasn't really readily accessible on the government's website. And we just decided we couldn't do it because, unbeknownst to us, and till we started doing reporting on it, the landlord or the owner of the building listed, when there might have been 100 complaints against the building and all kinds of housing code violations, the owner was the current owner, not the owner at the time of the violations. And we just felt that it wasn't right to tarnish somebody's reputation with something that was so misleading. And the problem is it took us figuring out that that was happening. There was no kind of warning on the data. And it just happened to be, for any of y'all who are familiar with relational databases, it was a highly relational database. And so they were picking up the owner from property tax rolls, I believe, and wasn't really thinking about what happened in the ones before. And as it happened, that was okay for the agency that was trying to collect the fines. The building still owed the fine, no matter who was owning it. So for their purposes, it was fine. For the purposes of holding a landlord accountable for what a landlord does, it was not. And so sometimes you end up with these things that are just not what they seem to be, and you feel a little bit lost that somebody somewhere knows this, but it gets so separated from the people with what you might call the domain knowledge that it's very difficult to find out more about what's going on. So that kind of disconnect between the people who are doing the governing or the inspecting and the source of the data can end up being really difficult. And I know Tom's had a lot of work with accuracy of spending data from the federal government and has done a lot of work on that. And I think we've all found data quality issues. Nobody expects that government records are going to be perfect. And I don't think that many people would argue that it's more important for you to scrub all of your data every day and put it in a nice, neat form and make sure that nobody could ever misunderstand it rather than, well, let's say govern. But it is kind of an issue of how do we figure out at what level something is misleading or wrong. And I think that that's some of the resistance that maybe you guys saw within government, is that people in the agencies would be able to look at it and say, wow, there's a lot of ways that people could misconstrue this and not treat it properly. And then the last thing I just wanted to mention is the idea of the difference between what I call data and records. I alluded to it earlier. But in terms of accountability, it's extremely difficult to hold people, agencies, companies, contractors, anybody accountable if you don't have their names. And if you don't know who they are. And one of the issues that's come up, at least at the federal level, it seems, is the tension between having personally identifiable information on a website versus being able to have enough information to make it useful. So as an example, in the data.gov, and we may or may not end up talking a little bit about that, the Justice Department has a spreadsheet in there that lists all of the trustee reports from bankruptcy court. These are entirely open records. You can go right into PACER and get all of these. There's nothing at all secret about them. But the Justice Department has scrubbed not only the name of the person in bankruptcy, but the case number, so that you can't go back from those spreadsheets to the actual case, which is completely public. So what happens is you end up scrubbing out anything that would allow you to figure out that quality. And so that ability to get back to the agency becomes even more important. We wanted to have more of a conversation. We wanted to invite you guys to participate. I know I have lots of questions for these guys, but I wanted to give you guys an opportunity to start it off if you'd like to. And if you could go to the microphone if there's anything you'd like to ask or say or get started on. Yeah, could you just use the microphone? I think it's on.
Hi. Sound folks, can we turn on the mic up here?
Or just project.
Or just talk loud. We're doing this, we're obsessed with, oh, wow, go ahead. We're kind of obsessed with this because they're recording the session, so we want to make sure everybody gets to hear
the
session.
I need to speak quietly now, it's on. I'm from the UK, and over the last couple of years, we've seen some strange impacts of what I think is some open government. A year or so ago, we had our MP's expenses opened up, and it made light that MPs were using their expenses scheme to top up their salaries, journalists jumped on with glee and exposed all the terrible things that our MPs were doing. And recently, I think that has come back to them when the MPs are now jumping all over the journalisms in the News International issues of phone hacking and email hacking that are coming around now. So we, from having a position of something being opened up, some government information being opened up, we've now got a festering sore or a battlefield between journalism and our elected members. And I just wanted to hear your opinion on how, whether you've seen that happen over this side of the Atlantic in any states, and how we avoid this breakdown in two of our institutions of government, journalism, and our elected processes from happening further.
Well, I know, Vivek, we talked about this before, the idea that, I would love you to describe it, the idea of what happens after you fight all these battles to open something up and then you get kind of beat up for it at the end.
Yeah, I think there's, unfortunately, the consequences as far as of government going the route of being much more open, transparent, a lot of times what happens is there's a very negative reaction, and it actually has a chilling effect on the whole notion of what open government can be. So just as a data point, right, as more and more data was being released, the number one criticism became about data quality. Well, the reality is it's all about context, right? So it's about, well, what is the mission of that agency? What is that agency doing? And in what context was that data being used? My view has always been you actually want to get to the golden source of data. You actually do not want government to try to massage the data, and you don't want the government to try to put it in the best light possible. You want to see the transactional systems rather than having the government put the best foot forward or the best picture forward. Now, the effect generally is when there's a lot of sort of criticism around that without taking the context in terms of how that data was being used, it gives all the people who are against open government the power to say, we told you so, right? This is the reason we shouldn't be moving forward in an open manner, because what is the outcome? You end up spending more money on defending why certain data sets are the way they are. You end up spending more money and resources away from your core mission and your focus on open government. And that, I think, unfortunately ends up having a much more chilling effect. And even though the open government movement, I would say, you know, you could point to specific aspects of it going back to World War II, it's actually pretty recent if you think about it in a holistic approach, where every single agency, every function of government is sort of organizing to move forward in that direction. So that will be one. And secondly, I think technologies that exist today, the network effect, social enterprises, right, they just weren't there before. So now you have this really amazing convergence of the social revolution plus government opening up. So the velocity at which you can hold people accountable is far greater than ever before. But I do worry about sort of disproportionate reaction sometimes to the information not being accurate, because I think it does swing the pendulum very heavily on the other end.
Well, I'd add that, you know, the MP expense example isn't the data quality stuff. I would love to talk about more. And actually, Vivek and Sunlight have had some interactions around spending data that we'll, I think we could talk about it at length. The expense reports are an interesting example, though, right? Because there is the same thing has happened here in the U.S., not through the crowdsourcing that The Guardian did, but that these reports actually existed on paper. You could go down to the Capitol and get them for a long time. We finally got, Sunlight finally got the House and now the Senate to start digitizing them, as PDFs. But we, when they release them on a quarterly basis, we process that information, put it up in a machine-readable format. And it's useful, but the first layer of stories we see are these kind of, like, somewhat toxic attacks on government. You know, it's the first layer of stories is like Nancy Pelosi buys flowers for her office. Oh no. Or you know, John Boehner offers bottled water to people who come to visit his office. And for what it's worth, I should say, like, this is an exception. If you go to like a GSA office in, you know, suburban Virginia, you'll see they don't even have art on the walls because they're so terrified of wasting money. But not to say they don't, but they waste it on contractors, not on office decorations. But the second level here, though, is all right, there's this kind of superficial thing that's used to just beat up on people for stupid partisan reasons. But you can't anticipate what this data is going to enable. Sunlight's taken that data. We've got a couple of years for the House, and we've been able to look at it and shed light on some questions we're really interested about. For instance, you know, this lets you take a look at who's on staff and their levels of pay, and it's allowed us to do analyses of the percentage of staffers who are leaving House offices to go to K Street and work as lobbyists. It's allowed us to look at actually the pay structure within offices. So you can see that, first of all, pay for congressional staff has been stagnant since at least 1980 when you adjust for inflation, whereas, you know, there's been at least some wage growth for everybody else. And actually, the allocation of those funds has been changing a lot. Chiefs of staff are getting paid a lot more, and everybody else is getting paid less. And a lot of the resources are being shifted to district offices, which are more about handling constituent requests than they are about making policy. So you can see this, like, this brain drain in action and start to use this to make your case around something more substantive, like, if we want a decent government, we're going to have to pay for it. That's you know, one of our issues that this data informs. I don't know that there is a way of getting around that sort of necessary toxic layer, though, of just sniping over dumb stuff and getting called out for data quality mistakes that are understandable and unavoidable. But I think that we've got to collectively figure out a way to, on the consumption side, tolerate it and be understanding of the civil servants who produce this stuff and say, you know, they're humans, and when you have a million rows in a database, there's going to be a problem or two. And on the government side, be a little bit less, you know, scared of this and understand that this is part of the cycle of releasing this stuff, and that you can still be proud of what you're releasing.
And I would just say not, I guess my first reaction is I don't consider phone hacking, like, that's a really bad thing. So they should probably be getting in trouble for this. So let's start with that. But I also think that it is, you know, one of the things that happens sometimes is that people forget that from journalism perspective, we're not there as part of a partnership. We're there to hold people accountable. And yes, a story can blow things out of proportion, but you know, your job is to watch people. Your job isn't to help them do their job better. And that there are other people out there whose job it is to help government do their jobs better. It just doesn't happen to be this one. So that's one side of it. And I really agree with Tom, this idea that when something is novel and new, you'll get people doing really outrageous things, but people get bored pretty darn quickly. You just expect that first wave of it, and my guess is it isn't happening every month or every year when the expenses come out anymore. So I think the more prepared agencies and officials are for what's going to happen and that it is going to go away, and that, yes, if you have been spending money on things you shouldn't have been spending money on, you're going to get caught. Yeah. I can just repeat your question if you'd like. Okay.
Is that better?
Yeah.
Yep. That is better.
I have a question about nuts and bolts implementation and the technology knowledge gap. I contract for the state of Texas through the Department of Information Resources. I'm just an individual. I'm not one of the big ones. And I actually worked as a very small, you know, in a small part on the what we're going to have a panel on in this room next. So I've seen both sides of this, and I'm seeing the pressure to stop using contractors, and I've seen some of the reasons for that pressure, yet I'm also seeing organizations and departments trying to hire high-quality tech people for salaries that are maybe 60% of what they would be offered in the marketplace. And so if you assume that a complete and total willingness and eagerness to cooperate with open government and provide data quality, if you're looking at organizations, someone joked on the project I'm on when I started that we were trying to bring the department into the 90s. And that's not really entirely a joke. We're getting there. So, you know, what do you, you know, do you have any suggestions for that?
Sure. So I think one conversation we don't talk a lot about in the context of open government is the transformation that these institutions are going through when it comes to the underlying systems, processes, technology, right? So a lot of these systems are actually being run on mainframes that go back to the 60s in terms of the core operations. But that's one of the reasons, you know, I go back to this whole notion of, well, what is that golden source of data? And as far as the technology gap, I think part of what needs to happen is these contracts that are in place and how government procures technology, you need to be able to actually hardwire the notion of open government up front as these contracts are being modified, right? New functionality is being built. Unfortunately, it's very much an afterthought. So you'll notice the level of expense, the money that's being spent in terms of fulfilling something as simple as a FOIA request, right, ends up costing a lot more than it really should. But this notion of are people hiring the right folks in government or not versus on the private sector side? Well, the reality is that majority of the systems are being operated by the private sector because there hasn't been a lot of capacity built within the government and the pace at which technology continues to evolve. I would argue that what you need is better contracts management. So hiring really smart, super smart people who are managing these multi-million, multi-billion dollar IT contracts in addition to getting the appropriate architects within government.
That's one thing that I would want to focus on. Also, as I now work at Duke University, and my job is to try to help reporters make their jobs easier. And one of the things that has always been a big stumbling block in terms of getting information is the simple difficulty of getting it out of government systems. And so one of the things we've talked about doing, and I haven't had a chance to do it yet, but I know that some systems are like this and some not, that, for instance, most 911 police systems, almost 911 response systems are done by maybe a half dozen different vendors around the country. And baking in the button for the public record is going to be a lot easier. And actually, in some cases, they have baked in the button for the public record. I was at a rural North Carolina police station not long ago, and they had a button that said produce the public record. And I'm not sure I'd agree that they gave me the whole public record, but at least it was the basics that everybody could agree on. And what that does is it frees you up to disagree on the things you actually disagree on and not spend time on the things that everybody thinks should be made public. I guess that's one way to put it.
And just to add to that, I remember, speaking of 911 systems, that these vendors had closed systems and had signed agreements that you couldn't share 911 data or records management systems amongst multiple municipalities because of their licensing agreements.
So which is probably illegal in most cities.
Right, they could force everybody to buy a unique system, which drives up their revenue. But I think this notion of creating that button or open APIs as a default is what we should be doing.
And in some states, they've done that as a policy. In Florida, for instance, I don't know whether it's a policy, a law, a regulation, or what, but when I was reporting down there in the 90s, one of the things that was a movement then was that every new computer system had to have a plan for how you were going to extract the data and the records that should be made public. And I believe that I've talked to people who have gotten, especially state police records since then, and it seems to have worked quite a bit well.
And you've also got HIPAA issues or
yeah.
other, you know, and try, it is a lot, one project I worked on, that was a huge concern because they were dealing with medical data.
Yeah, and I think the real question, I know that we have other questions that we want to get to, the real question is, right now, and Vivek can correct me on this, there is a process, at least at the federal level, to show how your system is secure when it should be, how you're going to keep private information private. There is no equivalent thing about how you're going to get out the public part. And so the idea is that if you can rewire things so that those are two equally important issues. I mean, the damage might be more on one side, but not the other.
Yeah, the one thing I would want to add to this is just any OpenGov panel at this conference, you're likely to hear people say that procurement is a huge problem, and it is. But some of these things, you know, there is the question of vendor lock-in and business models that are cynical and that we should avoid in contracting vehicles. But there's also just the fact that when we spend public money, we spend it differently than we do at our organizations, right? We reasonably place requirements around what we're going to collectively do with our tax dollars, saying, look, it's not acceptable for you to just give a contract to the guy you used before who you know will do a pretty good job. You've got to have an open process. You've got to make it available to small businesses. You've got to make it available to traditionally underrepresented types of vendors. There are good reasons for all this stuff. But and you know, and we could talk about actually open data mandates as part of this too. But it does make it harder to participate in the procurement process. It makes it slower and makes it more likely that only actual incumbents who know how to get on the GSA schedule, know how to comply with HIPAA and can satisfy these requirements are able to participate. And that really slows down the pace of innovation. There's not a great answer here. One thing that we're really proud of at Sunlight, we've done some apps contests. One of the best stories out of that was this project called GovPulse, which took the Federal Register, which is basically like the daily newspaper of the federal government. It's really important if you work at an agency or you follow particular regulatory beats as a journalist. They took this, which had recently been published as XML, and they made it searchable. They provided alerts. They just provided a great interface. And to the immense credit of the people who run the Federal Register, they went and talked to these folks, and the new Federal Register is an
and
effort
it's awesome.
From that small team. Yeah, and it's everything you could want it to be, basically. But the way they did that was they had an existing contracting vehicle with some gigantic vendor that they were able to say, could you carve out some money and sub to these guys? And they did. And basically you bypass all of these requirements and procedures that we've all collectively agreed to put in place to make sure procurement is fair.
And just on that procurement issue, I mean, we all know that, you know, if we want a totally secret government, that's going to be a lot cheaper. It's a lot easier and cheaper to do everything in secret than it is to have a democracy. So, you know, it's a factor of that.
I'm not sure it's cheaper for government. I mean, to be honest. So Alex Howard, O'Reilly Media, I know all of you from different contexts. And there are a number of things that you just went through I kind of would like to get back to a little bit. One is that you mentioned what journalists want, and I definitely hear you on the original sources, right? The thing about crowdsourcing The Guardian that they did is they had the actual doc, scanned it in, and you could see it. And there's technologies evolving like Document Cloud that could allow that kind of large-scale crowdsourcing here. It doesn't make it machine-readable right away, but you could see how that could happen. But you mentioned that journalists want things around what government spends, prosecutes, regulates, or inspects. The government is trying to release lots of that stuff. And actually, that crosses into what people think about as in the Gov2 world, right? The things that you could use around smart disclosure, right, for consumer products, et cetera, or transit data, et cetera. And that actually is more useful if you release it in those formats. And the thing I would say to you as a journalism professor who's influencing young journalists is to encourage them to be scrappy in making applications, right? They're leaving that all on the table for civic entrepreneurs, and they're using the exact same tools. So things like Don't Eat At, right, which is something you check in with in New York City, which uses food inspection data to bake into a location app, that's something that could be made by a data journalist, right? That's something that could be made by a local newspaper. And at a time when you're replacing $7 of print advertising revenue with $1 of online ad revenue, it seems to me that journalists are going to need to be entrepreneurial and scrappy and not be leaving this on the table for other people.
Yeah, and I think we've just seen each other a couple weeks ago at a conference where that was certainly the main idea of it. And I do think it's happening. It is not as profitable as it seems from the journalism perspective, but it does drive a lot of hits, and yeah, so it's been really useful.
And not just the hit, meaning that there's a specific revenue opportunity there that I think that a lot of people who are thinking about what the future of journalism would be remiss to leave on the table. In terms of this space, there's a danger right now I see around this issue of we're the transparency advocates. We only do this as journalists, right? If you release it, we're going to let you do that and let everyone else make sense of the data, and then we're going to sit back here and ask for everything else. What The Guardian is doing with the UK government's really interesting, because potentially they could be partnering with them.
Right.
The big question for people in government, unfortunately we don't have anyone in the panel from within the government, although obviously you were, is taking the data back once it's been cleaned or not. The two questions then, and they mostly go to you, Vivek. What were the barriers to taking data back once it was cleaned? Right, we know there were data in recovery.gov. Wasn't that good? It's still not, and the website cost way too much. ProPublica has a recovery tracker. Why couldn't you bring that stuff back in and say, you know, our Fourth Estate, one of the most esteemed data journalism entities on the planet, ProPublica has fixed this stuff. What are the barriers to bringing it back in to do something that's cooperative? And Tom, to her point right now in secrecy, information sharing is a huge issue with government. You talk to people internally, and they have enormous problems accessing the stuff that they need to. So maybe making the default open would actually increase their ability to
help
service, right? So I push back on that idea that secrecy is cheaper. It's actually much more expensive for them. And if you look at what's happening in the intelligence agencies, it's actually quite risky for us as a country.
Good point.
So I think let me answer your question through three examples. And one thing that I would love to talk about, sort of how do you build a startup ecosystem on top of all this data, right? So if you look at Garmin, its market cap is about $7 billion. If you look at Zillow, when it went public, it was valued at about $1 billion. And if you look at the Weather Channel, it was sold for $3.5 billion to NBC. All three of those examples are built on top of government data, right? GIS data, GPS data. And you look at that and you say, oh, that's interesting. Now, how does the government use it? The government watches the Weather Channel, right? Uses it regularly with FEMA in terms of tracking storms and trying to figure out how to allocate hundreds of millions of dollars of resources. If you look at Garmin, you know, a lot of these agencies, their vehicles are moved around and services are provided through these GPS services. If you look at Zillow, inspectors and sort of home valuations sort of are compared based on the algorithms that they've come up with. And most importantly, if you look at the open government movement and all these stories that have been written as a function of open data, trust me, that feedback loop is very healthy for democracy, and a lot of public policy decisions have been made as a result of that. So I actually think we're at this cusp of this amazing revolution, and we're beginning to see some amazing things happen. And to your point, I would agree that being open is not only cheaper, but it also drives innovation. So you're able to create economic value that you wouldn't be able to otherwise. So my view is that, you know, with this 400,000+ data sets in the U.S. federal government, but thousands of more at the state and local level, and then at the international level, you're looking at millions of data sets that are out there. We're just waiting for whether it's some entrepreneur who's going to disrupt the way entire sectors of the economy operate, from healthcare to education to transportation, or a reporter who's going to break a story that we didn't know about, or watchdogs, right, that are going to be able to hold government accountable. But government also, what was really interesting from my perspective is we've talked a lot about government to external innovation. We started seeing innovation amongst agencies where they started saying, wow, I didn't know you were operating in this mechanism, or what if we collaborated and started using these building these applications to streamline our own operations. So I think there's an amazing opportunity there, and we see more and more apps being built as a function.
And I know we have just a minute or two left, so Tom,
just to
jump
build
in.
On that, even apart from sort of the unrealized value or uses you can't anticipate, savings you might be able to achieve. I mean, there are really sort of there's a prosaic case too. If you talk to the folks at the National Archives who are facing a declassification burden, figuring out like how to declassify stuff, the queue is growing much faster than they can get through it. As these documents come up for review and release. Or you can look at, you know, FOIA compliance costs at any agency are huge. And if this stuff was just released, if it was possible to just release it without that layer of manual review, you could potentially make things a lot cheaper for them. I think we haven't tried that as much as we should. The examples that Vivek points to are great. There are a lot, though, for instance, around the payment data where the systems are decoupled. You know, what the public sees on USA spending is not what HHS uses to track its grants. They're two totally separate systems, and it's really just a pain in the ass for HHS to have to maintain this public stuff because it's not how they keep their books. It's a really thorny problem to bring this together so that it's a single system so that just the right stuff gets published. But that's the direction we've got to move in.
We have one last question, I think, and then we have to go.
Hi. Joe Leinbach from Deloitte. Still like art on walls in government. I guess part of the... we've talked a lot about government opening up government's data. I guess the other part of Gov 2.0 is government looking at data outside of itself and pulling it in. And you brought up a great example of the credit card data. My question is, how can government get better at looking outside itself for data sets to make smarter decisions? Where does it look? How does it partner to pull in data from outside? And I guess one tweak of that is social data. How does government use social data to make better decisions? Because it's hard to verify, hard to structure. What are your thoughts on that?
Sure. So from the social data perspective, I think the government needs to go through a transformation for the social era. It hasn't yet, right? I think it's early in that movement, and there are obviously concerns around privacy and security around how is government actually using that data and in what respect. Externally, I think the more interesting question is actually from a government as a regulator, right? How can we put up with the entire health sector being so opaque and secretive? Why is it that I know more about the next car I'm going to buy, which accidents it was in, and the price points than I do about the doctor I'm going to see, and the outcomes of certain procedures, you know, whether it's a knee replacement or a simple medical exam? So why is that? And I think over the years, what's happened is through self-preservation, these industries, whether it's the financial services sector or the healthcare sector or the education sector, have lobbied and have successfully gotten legislation passed that allows them to operate in secretive manners. And I think that's where you could see an amazing opportunity in terms of rethinking how these sectors must unleash sort of this data to allow the average citizen to be able to make better decisions.
Yeah, the one point I would add to this as far as interfacing with data outside of government is that there are obligations that come along with the public use of data. When the government's going to get involved with a data set and make it essential to its operations or start exposing it to the public, that data needs to be available to every citizen. I would argue free of cost, except possibly use fees, like user fees that recoup whatever the burden placed through its use is. And that can be, you know, problematic when you're dealing with proprietary data sets. Historically, this happens by the government asking for outside help to, you know, process its patent database or you know, whatever, and brings in a vendor, and then we spend decades actually trying to untangle that and make it as freely available as it ought to be. So I absolutely agree that you know, government should be looking outside for these opportunities. But it does get tricky because you're suddenly pulling away a lot of specific proprietary profit potential when you pull this stuff in and saying we're going to let, you know, 1,000 flowers bloom and hope that the value that's created is greater than what you guys were adding to your balance sheet. which can be a hard case to make.
And I think we're getting the signal we're out of time. So thanks so much for coming, everybody, and making it over here. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.